Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is election analyst Nathan Gonzalez, who joins us to discuss Tuesday's midterm elections. But first, here's this week's headlines. USDA increased production and offset some of those gains with higher domestic use in the latest version of the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. However, USDA did not lower export forecasts, which may happen in the upcoming months as low water levels on the Mississippi River and a strong U.S. dollar both add to the list of factors challenging growth in American agricultural trade. Looking forward, traders are keeping a close eye on the export situation in the Black Sea region and the recent comments from Chinese President Xi Jinping about the potential for military action in Asia. Negotiators have agreed to extend a cooling-off period and prolong the amount of time before a rail strike could possibly take place. Rail and union negotiators announced Wednesday the period would be extended until at least early December, an expansion from the previous November 19th deadline. Seven unions have already ratified the deal, but two others have rejected the agreement reached after the Biden administration stepped in following a breakdown of negotiations in September. Farm groups are calling on Congress to be ready to act to prevent a strike through the passage of legislation that would keep the industry running while negotiations take place. And finally, the red wave many were expecting on election night failed to sweep across the country. Instead, Democrats held on to many key races, including the toss-up districts represented by several members of the House Ag Committee. Exact margins are still up in the air, but it's looking like narrow majorities will exist in both chambers as Democrats were able to protect some of their vulnerable incumbents. Republicans may have missed out on the sweeping results they were hoping for, but the GOP was still able to pick up several seats previously held by Democrats in the House. Nathan Gonzalez is the editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Heading into Election Day, he had 81 seats at play in the House and three up in the air in the Senate. Some pundits were expecting many of those seats to be held by Republicans in the new Congress. When we spoke to Gonzalez, we asked him why that won't be the case.
Well, I think first in the Senate, things were about as we thought. We thought that the Senate was going to be close, and that's where we are. We're talking about focusing on Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia with the potential for a Georgia runoff. Those things all came to fruition in terms of where the battle for the Senate ended up coming down to. And in the House was the biggest surprise of the night, that it was expected that Republicans were going to win the House it was just about the margin. And as races started to unfold, it looked like, well, control of the House is at stake as well. And for me, what happened was independent voters, that there was an expectation that independent voters who disapprove of the job that President Biden is doing, who were concerned about the economy at a time when the economy is sputtering along, or there are concerns about gas prices, rise of cost of living, that those candidates or those voters would break for Republican candidates. And what we found is that they did not. That are toss-up races, that Democrats have been winning a disproportionate number of those toss-up races. When you look at the national exit poll, the independent voters broke overall 49% to 47% for Democratic candidates. And that was just something that wasn't expected in this political environment. And so that has created a skew in the ultimate number of House seats the Republicans are going to gain.
So as we look at this from a voter turnout perspective, I mean, are we seeing things that are driven more by new voters, by swing voters, by higher party turnout within either of the major party silos? I mean, is it some combination of the three? What are you seeing at this point?
Well, since we're still counting ballots across the country, I think it's still a little bit too early coming into that way. I think my expectation coming in was that we were going to have record turnout. And the way you get record turnout is you have an excited Republican Party, an excited Democratic Party, and an engaged group of independent voters. We'll see if that ends up fleshing out. To me, this is not going to end up being a base. The message or the theme of the election probably won't be that this was a base election, but what did those voters in the middle do? And that those voters who don't have, they've been sour on President Biden for maybe 6, 12, 18 months, that they did not punish Democratic voters. That's typically what happens in a midterm. If voters don't like the job the president is doing, then they punish members of the president's party because they can't vote against the president in a midterm. But those voters, independent voters, did not do that. And they also, maybe they were uncomfortable with voting for some Republican candidates, that they felt a sense of unease or dissatisfaction, but they weren't comfortable with the alternative. And that is going to be, I think, one of the themes, the takeaways from 2022.
One of the things that many people were watching heading into this particular round of voting was whether or not the Hispanic vote was going to trend toward the GOP. I know we're still, as you mentioned, kind of analyzing some of the figures that we've seen at this point, but what does the data that we have now tell us?
I think it's going to prove that the Hispanic vote is not monolithic. This is, we've been talking about this for the last number of cycles as more attention has been focused on Hispanic voters. And so we'll see, you know, for example, in Florida, in South Florida, where Republicans continue to make gains with Hispanic voters, particularly Cuban Americans, helping lead to Governor Ron DeSantis racking up a huge win in his reelection effort there. Marco Rubio with a huge win in his reelection race for the Senate. But then when we go to Texas, the story is a little bit different, that there were three competitive races that we were watching in Texas. Two of them, Democrats ended up winning. Vicente Gonzalez in the 34th district, Henry Cuellar winning re-election in the 28th district, in the race that Republicans won, the 15th district, where Gonzalez decided not to run for re-election. But that district also was redistricted a little bit to include more Anglo voters rather than being so heavily Hispanic. So again, I think we have a mixed result. Republicans were making some gains coming into 2022, but that might have, it may not be as widespread as what the narrative was leading us to believe before the midterms.
We'll be right back to discuss the rural vote, 2024 implications, and more with election analyst Nathan Gonzalez right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. In recent elections, the Republican Party has run up the score in rural America and offset some potential losses in more urban centers. Nathan Gonzalez with Inside Elections says it's a little early to tell if that trend continued in the 2022 midterms, but we do already know of one notable exception.
One key race, the Pennsylvania Senate race, we saw that not hold true as much, meaning that Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman was either matching or exceeding Joe Biden's 2020 rating or percentage in counties all across Pennsylvania, particularly not just, I'm not talking about Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, but more rural counties, again, where Fetterman was doing better. And so if that trend were the trend of rural areas only getting more Republican, if that was holding true, then you would have seen Fetterman fall below what Biden did in 2020, but that wasn't the case. Now you could say, well, maybe this was unique to Fetterman because he has more of a working class appeal, because he appears to be allergic to wearing pants, or, you know, he always wears his hooded sweatshirt, and Dr. Oz maybe have been branded as an out-of-stater, just a guy from New Jersey that you see on TV. So it could have been unique, but that was one place that stuck out to me where a rural area actually shifted a little bit more toward Democrats than 2 years ago.
Well, and I realize that it's probably a little bit early to ask this next question, but what the heck? We're a few days past the midterms. Let's talk about 2024 and the potential implications and potential implications that we've seen from these midterm elections, because I know it's still early. I know we haven't even sworn in the next Congress yet. They haven't had a chance to do some of the legislation that they will do that will ultimately influence how voters will feel in November of 2024. But based on what you saw on Tuesday, how do you think that impacts the 2024 cycle?
Well, let's start on the Democratic side. In a way, this almost, I feel like it emboldened President Biden in heading into 2024. I've been in the camp where I don't believe President Biden's going to run again, but the fact that he didn't get shellacked in the midterm elections is causing maybe him or some other people on the Democratic side to think differently about how they think about him running again. Now, to Democrats, won or maybe exceeded expectations in spite of him, not because of him. And I think Democrats should be a little cautious from just lining up behind an incumbent president whose job approval rating is less than 45%. That's not a strength of position. But if it causes him to think he's in a strong position and to progress, then that could impact that 2024 race. If he doesn't run, then it's going to be a little bit wide open. The vice president will probably run. Maybe Secretary Buttigieg, formerly Mayor Pete from South Bend. And then I think a candidate to watch on the Democratic side is Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, who is in a tough reelection fight this year. On the Republican side, Governor DeSantis had a great night in Florida. You probably couldn't draw it up any better in terms of how to continue on your presidential run than winning re-election in a battleground state by 20 points. That's a good way to do it. President Trump is getting a lot of criticism because his high profile endorsed candidates did not do well. But I am not convinced that will convince him to not run. Until I hear the words, "I am not running for president of the United States," come out of Trump's mouth, I'm going to believe that he is running. And he always finds a way to blame losses or mistakes on someone or something else. And so even if his candidates didn't do well, that does not necessarily deter him. It could cause cause some Republicans to say, "Oh, he's not as strong as what we thought he was, and let's take him on." That opens up that possibility. I still believe Trump is the most popular politician among base Republican voters, not Republican politicians, but actual voters. And if Trump doesn't run, then it's going to be a wide open race. You're going to have a half dozen senators, Governor DeSantis, Governor Glenn Youngkin, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, Mike Pompeo. It's going to be a wild show if Trump doesn't run.
So no shortage of storylines to look at coming out of these midterm elections, and no shortage of storylines to look at going into the upcoming 24 elections. And Nathan, we appreciate you joining us to discuss them all.
No problem. We'll see you soon.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, Hannah Pagel takes a look at how money is flowing in a key USDA program in this week's Map It Out.
Fresh funding from the Inflation Reduction Act is set to funnel $2 billion into USDA's Rural Energy for America program, part of USDA's Rural Development's mission area. REAP assistance is available to rural small businesses and agricultural producers who get at least half of their gross income from their operations. The program provides guaranteed loans of up to 75% of the cost of eligible projects, grants covering up to 25% of project cost, and combined grant and loan guarantee funding for up to 75% of project cost. This map shows the REAP grant totals by state in fiscal year 2022. Iowa received the largest share of grants at $2.4 million. Minnesota was second at $2.3 million, followed by Missouri at $1.6 million. More than 75% of the annual grant and guaranteed loan funding from the program in recent years has been for solar projects. In fiscal year 2022, solar projects accounted for more than 900 of the 1,200 grants awarded in the entire program. Translating that into dollars, solar efforts accounted for $31 million of the total grant funding of $43 million. According to a USDA administrator, the department is working on finding a way to distribute some of the new funding to underutilized technologies like wind projects energy efficiency projects, and biogas and biomass systems. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel. Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we are excited to continue our midterm election coverage with this week's panel. Excited to be joined this week by Ethan Lane with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Mike Strands with the National Farmers Union, and Christy Seifert with the American Soybean Association. Appreciate all of you taking the time. And Mike, I want to go to you first, because as we look through the results that we have thus far, it is kind of a better election cycle than was initially predicted for the Democratic Party. And a lot of folks kind of wondering how things are shaping out on the rural vote side of things. And I know we're still gathering some exit polling data and some additional insights, but what does NFU make of the role of the rural vote in the these better than expected Democratic results thus far?
Yeah, with the big amount of work that the 118th Congress will have next year with the Farm Bill coming up, it was important that rural voters get out and make their voice heard. There are a few changes in the agriculture committees, and there'll be some new faces that will be part of this farm bill process. But with the rural vote turnout, farmers and ranchers and rural residents had a chance to speak up. So we're looking forward to seeing what we can work with the new agriculture committee members that'll be coming in, with all the leadership that may be in flux here in the weeks ahead. So we'll see what we can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Ethan, obviously there are still some things yet to be determined, but as things sit right now, the conventional wisdom says we're going to get a Republican majority in the House of Representatives and a very narrow Republican majority in the House of Representatives. What do you think in terms of how that will impact sort of the governing that the party will try to do, given the fact that, yes, they will have the majority, but by a very narrow margin?
Yeah, I think that's the really interesting question. As we watch these last few races on the West Coast kind of resolve themselves, if they kind of hold where they are, I think you're right, we're going to see that narrow majority. And that really sets off that leadership and direction conversation in the Republican Party. You know, we know where G.T. Thompson's head is at as far as the presumptive chairman incoming of the House Agriculture Committee. We know he plans to get to work quickly and engage in that farm bill process. I think everyone's anxious to get going in that space. But, you know, what kind of support is there going to be? A lot of us, I know, had conversations with a lot of these new incoming members, particularly those that may be sort of aligning themselves with the Freedom Caucus into the party. You know, it's going to be interesting to see, given the fact that they had, I think it's fair to say, a pretty horrible night on that far right side of the Republican Party on Tuesday night. You know, they're going to, despite that, be in a fairly important position as far as that majority for the Republicans coming into next Congress. And what's that going to mean for a farm bill, given what we know is going to be a much more fiscally conservative approach to governing? I think that's something that everyone in agriculture is going to really have to think about and engage in as we move into the next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Christy, obviously, we're not going to know the final congressional picture really finally until the December runoffs for the Georgia Senate race. Still a number of races being discussed and being voted and being tallied, between now and then. But we know a little bit more, quite a bit more, actually, now than we did Tuesday morning about what the next Congress is going to look like. Wonder, what do you think thus far about how that's impacting your 2023 legislative outlook?
I'll tell you, I think we are really pleased that we have a number of champions for agriculture in Congress returning, whether those are the vulnerable seats that those vulnerable candidates that we were concerned about, or those champions that we've maintained great relationships for a long time. Both sides of the aisle, we're happy to see some of these members returning. We have a lot of relationship building ahead of us as we think about the new members who were elected, and especially across soy country. So look forward to working with them and many others to tackle some really important initiatives like the next Farm Bill reauthorization. First, we have a few things in lame duck to approach first, right?
We'll be right back to focus on the farm policy ramifications of the midterm elections with our panel right after this.
know, AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time. Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back. The midterm elections appear to be creating an environment on Capitol Hill where slim majorities will reign in both chambers. Mike Stranz with the National Farmers Union says that could lead to a more moderate farm bill.
It looks like with these narrow majorities, either way, that the farm bill is going to have to move towards the middle. And I think that we've seen the most success with farm bills when there is bipartisanship and when there is an effort to bring more and more diverse voices into the farm bill discussion. And I think that bodes well for a 2023 farm bill. Yeah, there's going to be some narrow majorities. There's going to have to be some vote counting that goes on. But I think that, you know, if we understand, both sides understand, politically speaking, what needs to be part of a farm bill, what sort of deals can be done, that really bodes well. And I think that a lot of the most successful farm bills we've seen have been when there's been some bipartisanship like that. And hopefully we can use that tradition again in 2023.
Well, and Mike, as we continue our look at the upcoming farm bill, a lot of folks heading into the process were expecting this to be a much more climate-friendly piece of legislation. How do you think Republican control of the House and or Senate would impact the prospects of climate language in the upcoming farm bill?
Well, with the some of the heavy lifting being done through the Inflation Reduction Act this past summer, I think that there's still that need to make sure that we're addressing conservation and climate goals in tandem through the farm bill. And if there's a Republican majority in either or both of the chambers, I think that there's still on that other side a Democratic majority or at least a vocal minority in both or one of those chambers as well. So I think there's just with how razor thin these margins are going to be, there's going to be a need to work together on this. And I think that that, again, bodes well for making sure that agriculture and family farmers and ranchers are part of the solution when it comes to climate, and the farm bill should be well set up for that.
Christy, earlier in our conversation, you had mentioned that attention, at least your attention, is now shifting to the lame duck session. As you consider what might be coming out of that lame duck session, anything in particular you're going to be watching or perhaps working on for agriculture?
Yes, I think all of agriculture right now wants to see two very qualified nominees move toward confirmation. We really hope that Doug McCaleb and Alexis Taylor can move forward to the finish line and be in these positions that are critical to agriculture and those of us whose commodities or whose products are really finding those markets on the global stage. So we hope that we can see movement in those nominations in the near term. We'll see. We're certainly pushing for it. Many others are as well. And then I think also, you know, we have other issues that the Congress will tackle, but we are looking ahead to the Farm Bill and want to lay the foundation for a successful Farm Bill next year. So that is making sure that we are connecting with our four Ag Committee leaders in the House and in the Senate, as well as taking cues from them on who else in budget committee races, in leadership races, other members who are going to be influential in the steps ahead for laying that foundation for a successful farm bill. So those are top of mind for ASA.
Mm-hmm. Well, still waiting to figure out who some of those folks will be sworn that will be elected will ultimately be sworn in January of 23. But Ethan, when they come to work, obviously it's you know, we're a few days out from the finalization of the 2022 votes. Let's talk about 2024 already. Let's think about then what when you kind of go through what farm policy will have on the agenda. Obviously, a farm bill among them. But what do you think the impact of the 2024 election cycle will be on kind of that next 2 years of farm policy?
Well, I think there's really going to be a renewed focus on rural voters' impact on that national landscape, right? You know, a lot of the conversation amongst pollsters, and you and I were talking about this before we went on camera this morning, trying to figure out, gosh, where'd we miss again this time? I don't think that they did necessarily. I think the polling was actually probably a little more accurate this cycle than we've seen in previous cycles, but trying to figure out how to reach some of those voters and really connect with them. You know, we're already seeing that play out as far as some of the arguments being made, you know, by Chairman Scott, some of the legislation that he's working on. He's still struggling to find support from us or Farm Bureau or others on some of those pieces of legislation to support small family farmers and ranchers. But there's clearly a take there, right, of more financial support, more safety net, more programs to support those small producers. That's one argument that we're going to see. We're going to see the Republican side continue to make their arguments, looking for some ways to empower producers to build new markets and certainly lean on that need for trade. And I couldn't agree with Christy more. You know, the party's going to need to really show whoever's in charge in the Senate that they can get those nominees confirmed. And the Biden administration is going to have some work to do to show that they're serious about trade, that they want to get into that conversation and truly build out some more markets for our agricultural products. You know, that was a real bright spot, one of the only ones during COVID, particularly for the beef industry. So I think there's some avenues that can be pursued here to make some important arguments to farm country about what the two parties are offering, whether or not they take us up on that and take those pursuits seriously. That's going to be the real question. And I think a lot of people are going to have to really figure out where the misses were here in the last week as far as what their arguments are going to look like moving into 2024.
Of course. Well, the election day may be behind us, but an election result analysis is just beginning. And folks, we appreciate you joining us to offer your thoughts. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, Hannah Pagel takes a look at how consumers are spending their food dollar in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
USDA data shows that Americans have spent more on food in 2022 than before the COVID-19 pandemic, even when adjusted for inflation. But the mix of how they are spending their food dollar is also changing. This chart shows a change in U.S. inflation-adjusted monthly food spending from January to August of 2022 compared to the same time in 2019. Food bought from grocery stores and prepared at home is represented by the green bars, and food bought from restaurants or cafeterias and consumed away from the home is represented by the blue bars. You can see that people spent almost 8% more on food from grocery stores in January, continuing a trend that was established during the pandemic. However, more food was purchased away from home as pandemic restrictions began to ease and more restaurants allowed in-person dining. The highest increase was a 12% jump in April. USDA believes the increase may be because people are buying more food overall or buying more expensive options at both grocery stores and full-service restaurants. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The AgriPulse team will be hitting the road. I'll be in Kansas City for the annual convention of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. Other members of the AgriPulse editorial team will also be on site, including Hannah Pagel, Jackie Fatka, and Sarah Wyant. Be sure to check out next week's show for the latest from the event. Elsewhere, our Philip Brasher will be at the Sustainable Ag Summit in Glendale, Arizona, Wednesday and Thursday. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for all of this and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.